You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.
Today on our show, I'm talking with Christine Catano. She's talking to me from Ithaca. Christine, thanks so much for talking with me today.
Thank you for having me.
Christine, tell me a little bit about what you're working on at the moment.
At the moment, I've been working on just trying to draft new work. Ever since my book came out, I felt a little bit unmoored and that I didn't know what I wanted my next project to be. But I've been managing to write every day for the past month or so, and I'm seeing some patterns in terms of what I'm interested in now, and I think I'm looking at landscape in a new way. I'm thinking about what it means to live in a very rural space. I live right outside of Ithaca, and it's very rural where I live. And as I walk around, I notice how the landscape really shows where man has moved in, and I'm thinking about what it is to always be in a space where I'm almost an intruder. And as I've been taking these daily walks, that's what I've been noticing, and I notice that that's what's coming out in my writing. What does it mean to walk around in a space where I don't always feel like I belong in multiple ways? So that's the direction that I feel my work starting to go right now.
And when you talk about writing every day, you're working on poems? Is that largely what you're working on every day, or?
For the most part, I'm in the initial drafting stages, so I'm just writing, and usually when I'm doing these free writes, they come out as prose, but when I go to look at them more closely and I work to revise, I start putting them into lines a little bit more. So I still think I'm working towards poetry at this point.
And it's interesting you talk about Ithaca and being outside of it. Ithaca, you know, I don't know a lot about. I know my father went to school there, and I remember my mother saying that the weather there and the landscape, as you talked about, is a little I don't know how to put it. That doesn't sound sort of dark, but she said it was kind of dreary and lent to this kind of feeling that you get when it keeps raining all the time. And I mean, just correct me if that's not what you're feeling there at all, but is there something there to the weather, the environment of Ithaca itself?
Oh, certainly. Right now we're actually in the honeymoon period of Ithaca, where the sun is out and the leaves haven't changed quite yet. It's still green. It's very beautiful. But very soon, yes, it's going to start raining, and then it's going to start snowing, and it won't stop probably until around April. And so there is a very dreary, dark time, a very gray time that lasts, it seems like forever when you're in the middle of it. But I do appreciate these seasons, and so when I'm in the darkness of that, I do anticipate spring, and when spring comes, it is such a relief, and I appreciate it that much more.
And does that have anything to do with the title of your book that came out in 2017, Sky Country?
Actually, no. I was working on Sky Country, actually, when I was living in Texas. And when I moved to Texas, I had heard that I was moving to the West, or West Texas, that sometimes is called Big Sky Country, and I'm sure I had that phrase in the back of my head. But Sky Country itself actually comes from a Korean word, Hanodnara, which is a kenning that literally translates to sky country, and it's a word for heaven, and that was what I was working towards in these poems, but I'm sure the landscape of Texas influenced that as well.
So I know you're going to read a few poems for us today, and are you reading from Sky Country?
Yes, I'll read from Sky Country.
So what is the first poem you're going to read? Can you tell me a little bit about it, or just jump right into it if you want?
Sure, I'll talk a little bit about it. The first poem I'll read is called Before the Divorce, A Dry Thunderstorm. And I do consider this a very Texas poem. It was a poem that was written in Texas and certainly in response to the climate and the culture and the weather of Texas. It feels very Texas to me. I was thinking about what it means to be a woman in Texas and the expectations that are placed upon me as a woman. And even though I've never been divorced or married, I was thinking about these gender roles, and this is a poem that came out of that. So this is called Before the Divorce, A Dry Thunderstorm. Though lightning sections the sky and thunder breaks, then breaks again, rain will not come. I near the fence, trash bag in hand, the narrow backyard expanse like the stage for a school play after the children have long gone. I see approaching what might be the shapes of horses or the long, wind-pressed shadows of trees. This, our shard of the American dream, a house with a fence, the same houses and fences on either side. The automatic sprinklers sputter on, spitting fake rain across flattened scabs of grass. Tonight, drought is abstraction, a hollow phrase I cannot grasp. So too is divorce, how we will split a house. It is small, the TV lit window just one of many in the dark, a neighborhood of boat lights afloat on what must be a finite sea. The pattern repeats, heat lightning, thunder, silence, the sky still stubborn with indigo clouds. Rain will come, though probably not tonight. I wait anyway. The thick air hovers just above me.
Thank you. So, to talk about that one a little bit, you it seems so full of imagery, and now that you mention it, you know, kind of Texas, perhaps, although I've never been there. But you're also talking about your, you know, as a relationships you're talking about as a relation, gender roles, essentially. Tell me a little more about that. I didn't pull so much out of there about gender. Now that you said that, I kind of layer that over it. But what did you mean by that? It's more about your relationship to the environment.
I suppose so. When I moved to Texas, I felt acutely aware of my gender in a way that I hadn't before. I had moved there for graduate school. I was doing my PhD, and most of the female graduate students around me were all married and had children, and it was something that felt very foreign to me at the time. I thought, this is not something that I'm interested in or that I've thought about, but then to suddenly be surrounded by women my age who were at that stage in life, it made me stop and think for a moment, and I didn't really know how to react to it. And then as I started working on these poems, I started working in persona, and so I was taking on the persona of various woman characters and just exploring these experiences that weren't exactly my own, but I was wondering, what does it mean to be a woman who's going through divorce? What does that feel like? Especially when there are so many expectations placed on what your role should be, and to step outside of that role, how does that get reflected in other parts of your life? So I think that's where this poem was coming from. But I was also just in general working on a series of persona poems where I was examining, again, what it means to be a woman and what it means to step outside of the expectations of that.
And this is also an issue in academia as well, isn't it? I often think of, if it's appropriate to speak to that, you know, in being in teaching, educational institutions, academia, there's also pressures and expectations depending on your gender as well, isn't there?
Oh, I'm sure, yes. I know that. I started teaching college when I started graduate school for my master's degree, and I was 22 when I first started teaching college, and just being very aware of what my appearance would or how my appearance would affect me when I stepped in the classroom, that I certainly didn't look like a professor. I looked like just another undergraduate student. And always being aware of that, and something that I've always had to, not necessarily in in a bad way, not always in a bad way, but something I've always been aware of, and I've had to craft my persona in the classroom as well because of how I appear to students.
Well, isn't there also pressure, depending on, you know, whether you're on a tenure track or not? I mean, both my parents were in academia. They were both college professors, and I remember just hearing, you know, so much at the dinner table every day about politics, and friends that I have in teaching now, especially women, talk about the pressure that they're under and the stress as women, as opposed to their peers who are men, because of the push to publish, to move towards tenure, to be overworked, knowing that you know, for those who are on a tenure track, is that too far off topic, or is that something that's also part of gender in both situations, I guess, Texas and Illinois?
Oh, well, certainly.
I mean, Ithaca, yeah.
Gender plays a part in every aspect of my life. I know that I am in a tenure track position right now, and I do take on a lot of responsibilities both in my professional life and outside my professional life, and I know that all the aspects of my identity play into how I deal with that. And yes, it is overwhelming and tiring and exhausting, but at the same time, I feel lucky to be in a place where I can recognize who I am and I can recognize what I'm doing, and so at least being aware of how my identity plays into these issues, even if I can't always control it, that awareness I still find to be helpful in coping with all the things that come my way.
So let's hear another poem. You're reading us another one from the same book, correct, Sky Country?
Yes. So as I was working through these persona poems, I realized that I still wanted to revisit a lot of my family history. And so my father's side of the family is of Japanese descent, and my father and his family were incarcerated during World War II in the Japanese-American incarceration camps. And that was an experience that I touched on a bit in my first book. But when I was working on this second book, I realized it was something that I wanted to continue to explore, continue trying to figure out how I would tell this story. And so I settled on a persona again to tell this story from the first person. The persona is based loosely on my grandmother, but it's mostly a fictional account that this poem presents. And the poem is called Gaman.
Okay, wait a minute. Before you read it, I just want to ask a few questions about that, because that's very powerful. So your father was in one of what, like the camps they had at Manzanita, the internment camps in the United States during World War II. Is that what you're saying?
Yes.
And your mother was not in the camps at that time. And you weren't either, but he was, because oftentimes whole families were put in these camps.
Yes. My father was 16 when he was incarcerated.
Right. Oh my gosh, yeah, that's such a kind of horrific thing. I was just reading. I try not to read too much politics, but I read someone say, you know, when someone made a comment, you know, something about America being great again, and they said, when was America great? Mm-hmm. And the response was World War II. And the response to that was, have you ever heard of the internment camps that we set up in this country? You know, that was a great time. That was a horrible time. So thank you. So please, I'd love to hear the poem.
Okay, so the poem is titled Gaman. And Gaman is a Japanese term that loosely translates to endurance or persistence or perseverance. And it was a term that was used to understand the Japanese-American response to the incarceration orders. And that was it was a word that I wanted to explore in this poem. So I'll read the poem now. Gaman. It was night when the buses stopped. It was too dark to see the road, or if there was a road. So we waited. We watched. We thought of back home, how the orchards would swell with fruit, how the trees would strain then give way under their ripe weight. The pockmarked moon, the face of an apple, pitted with rot. But of course not. Someone would intervene, would make of our absence a profit. When we came, the boat anchored at San Francisco Bay swayed for hours, the gauntlet of uniformed men so intent on finding cause to turn us away. And now again we wait, we watch. Our American children press against us with their small backs, which gives us pause. For the sake of the children, we'll teach them to forgive the fears of others, the offenses. But what we don't anticipate is how the dust of the desert will clot our throats, how much fear will conspire to keep us silent, and how our children will read this silence as shame. However much we tried, we thought, to demonstrate grace. When the buses stopped, it was too dark to see the road. Or if there was a road, it was night. And instead of speaking, we waited. Instead of speaking, we watched.
Thank you, Christine. It's so powerful. Tell me a little bit more about that term. You said that term was the Japanese-American response to what the Americans were doing. Can you tell me a little bit more about that term?
Sure. So gaman is a Japanese word, and this is what I've heard both in family history and what I've read in history books when I was researching the incarceration, that it was a term that the elders, the Japanese elders, would say when thinking about how to deal with the orders to show up with only what you can carry to be arrested, essentially, and put in these prison camps. And the elders would say, gaman, persevere, persistence. And I think it's a term that informs a cultural response. I don't think it's certainly not the only way to understand that. But it was a term that I've always been interested in because I don't speak Japanese and I don't have a direct sense of what this word means. I can only read translations of it. So working through this poem was my way of trying to understand what it means to face adversity in this particular way, to acquiesce in some ways. And acquiesce, again, doesn't feel like the right word. But working through this poem is how I found my way to the word grace as a possible translation, as a possible way of understanding how and why people would react in the way that they did.
That's fascinating. It also sounds kind of stoic, you know, a sort of stoic response. We will do it. We will deal with it. You know, it's as opposed to resistance or questioning authority. It seems almost the opposite of that, right? It's about enduring hardship without questioning the hardship or talking about the tragedy or the unfairness of the hardship.
Yes. And it was I think it's the strength behind the word that often gets left behind. And I thought grace and strength and thinking about how those two words can work together within this larger term. And again, this comes mostly from my inability to understand Japanese and not having any sense of how this word gets used colloquially or all the connotations, the cultural connotations behind it, and seeing it only in these very difficult historical circumstances, and then me wanting to figure out what does this word mean, what are all the shades of meaning underneath this word.
Yeah, that's clear. And grace and strength sounds kind of a wonderful combination of words, and it sounds almost noble. There's something formal about that. Grace and strength is something that I think I haven't encountered much in my life, you know, perhaps, you know, it's a way of approaching things as opposed to, I don't know what its opposite would be, you know, but as opposed to the opposite, and that doesn't sound like something that I've encountered a lot in the United States. I mean, and maybe I'm romanticizing the idea of what it might be, it might mean in the context of Japanese culture, you know, in common use, but it's a word that doesn't sound like an American experience. It's kind of what I'm saying.
I agree with that, certainly.
In a way it sounds like a very, a way of managing life and hardship that comes from a kind of, for lack of a better word, wisdom or community support, even, which is also not something I think I'm used to hearing.
Well, it's interesting that you say that. As you were talking, I was thinking it does rely on a community in some way. And it's one thing if you're the only one who's being taken out, but to be taken out as a community, at least being able to have that community with you in some way, it's a strange thing to think about, but I think community does play into how that word works.
Mm. Well, thank you. And you have one more poem you're going to read?
Yes, I'll read one more poem. So this collection has very different poems throughout it. So I have poems about the incarceration. I have these persona poems by various women. And then I continued a type of poem that I had started in my first book, where I was imagining this character who's named Insomniac. And she's named Insomniac because she's an insomniac. There's nothing really more to the character than that. But she's sort of taken on her own life in some way. And so this is a poem that's just about her. And it's called Insomniac Starts an Exercise Routine. The first week passes, then two. Soon, it has already been 6 months. A mile's distance feels less slog, more flight. Her body in flux. When she reaches behind to scratch a shoulder blade, she feels a thickness, a heft where before had been just bone. New swellings rise, not tumors as first feared, but muscles, the names of which she has to look up in a textbook. Latissimus dorsi, biceps brachii, vastus lateralis, the words long and Latin like the names of stars. Others comment on the angles now articulated in her face, but it isn't, as they say, the shedding of an old layer, and it isn't, as has been said, the angel emerging from its stone. The end product will be a complete transformation, total and final. Beneath her skin, a new form pieces itself together. The bruises that speckle her limbs bud from within. One day, as if waking from a dream, she'll find a new face in place of the old, perhaps with gills etched behind her ears, maybe fins in place of feet, or instead of arms, wings.
Thank you. So beautiful in so many ways. So that feels, especially in relationship to the last one, of course, so transformative personally. You know, we're not talking about a community now. It's that feels deeply personal, and especially the way it ended, a kind of liberation almost.
Yes, yes. As I look at the collection now, I see, I suppose, all the various webs that hold these poems together. When I was first working on the poems, I felt like I was working on very separate projects, but as I started to put them into a collection, and it was particularly in the organizing of the collection, that I started to see how everything started to to show their roots a little bit. I could see how one poem from one section related to a poem from the other section. And I saw that as I was putting the collection together, and now looking back at it with a little bit more distance even from there, I see how it's still very, I suppose, tied to the time that it was written, and that most of these poems were written within the span of 2 or 3 years, and so it makes sense that even if on the surface they have different ways of expressing themselves, the underlying themes are all very much together.
I love that, and thank you so much for sharing those poems with me, with the listeners. Before I ask you the last question, is there anything else you want to say about forthcoming work? There'll be links here so people can find your books and potentially purchase them, but in terms of how we started the interview and what you're working on now, will that evolve into another book of poems? Is that what you're thinking?
I'm thinking that it will. I'm hoping that it will. I'm working towards, yes, another book of poems, and thinking that I'm probably also working toward a book of prose as well, but I'm a slow writer and I'm a slow thinker, and it takes me a while to really flesh out what it is that the project will eventually be. So it'll be some time, but I'm certainly working towards at least one more collection of poetry and probably another book of prose.
Christine, I'm always curious what people are reading. What are you reading at the moment?
I'm actually reading Beloved right now, Beloved by Toni Morrison. I always teach a freshman seminar class every fall, and this is my third time teaching this class, and we always read Beloved in this class. And Beloved is probably one of the books that I have never gotten tired of reading. Every time I read it, it's surprising. Every time I read it, there's something new. So I'm reading that, reading it along with my class, and still being surprised by it.
Christine, thank you so much for talking with me today. It's really been a pleasure hearing about your work and your reading us the poems, and I wish you great luck on your next book.
Thank you so much for having me.
You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.